Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. It is widely recognized that the global economy is weakening. There are many reasons for this: inflation, supply chain issues, high levels of debt, the conflict in Ukraine, and the West's appetite for sanctions. On this edition of the program, we discuss how all these issues are changing the structure of the global economy. Crosstalking the global economy, I'm joined by my guest, Mitch Feierstein in New York. He is an investor and author of the book Planet Ponzi. Here in Moscow, we have Yaroslav Lisovolik. He's a program director at the Valdai Discussion Club. And in Beijing, we cross to Andy Mok. He is a senior research fellow at the Center for China and Globalization. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. I want to ask all three of you the same question right off the bat here. Mitch, I'll go to you first here. It's widely described as a global recession is afoot here. But depending on who you ask, it's always kind of politicized blame game and pointing fingers. All three of you look at this professionally. So what is driving this global downturn? Go ahead, Mitch.
Well, thanks, Peter. It's not that complex a situation. And, people are saying that we might be headed for a economic recession, but we're actually in an economic recession. As you know, the metric that is being used is an outdated, backward-looking metric. So we are in an economic recession, and it can get much worse from where we are today. The problem is there's no truth in the media. You've got a dishonest media that doesn't report things, and they censor whatever they don't like. I mean, we've seen this across the board. Now, as far as what's caused this, we've had over a decade of reckless central bank money printing that has inflated grotesque asset bubbles in equities, fixed income, property, and every asset class across the board, except the commodity markets. This has been compounded by these sanctions that you mentioned a little while ago. What we have to think about, though, is the way that things unfold. And right now, we're seeing a massive transition, the end of the petrodollar in the West, U.S. dollar hegemony can easily collapse from here. We're seeing, and if we look to history and we look at Japan as the model, they've had three lost decades of floundering economic policy. And what you're seeing now is you're seeing an unraveling of what too much quantitative easing looks like. You've seen the Japanese yen drop 23% in the past year. You've seen the British sterling dropped 12% since the end of last year. So what you're seeing is a precipitous decline in currency values while you're seeing 20% inflation across the board, which is eviscerating the consumers. So we are in a recession, and it will probably morph into a depression. And what's happened with the sanctions that have never worked is you have the U.S. dollar is going to, right now it's strengthening, but a bunch of countries that have gotten together, because it's not just the United States versus Russia, as the propaganda has it. It's Russia, China, India, Iran, Saudi Arabia, UAE, and a bunch of other countries that are going to de-dollarize and go on a quasi-gold standard, which is moving in the direction that we're headed right now.
And it probably wouldn't be a bad idea. Yaroslav, let me ask you more or less the same question here, but Mitch did a really good job in answering that. How is it structurally changing the global economy? Because de-dollarization has been mentioned here, outsized asset prices, which we've been watching, quantitative easing. How is that changing? And because, I don't want to focus this program on sanctions exclusively. I want to talk about how the global economy is changing and to whose advantage, actually. Go ahead, Yaroslav.
Well, first of all, I would agree that the detonator to a significant degree of the recessionary fears and recessionary risks that we're seeing now has to do with the excessive monetary stimulus undertaken primarily by advanced economies. And then there's, of course, the legacy of imbalances that we've had in the preceding decades, again, to a significant degree concentrated in the advanced world. And then on top of this, you have the triggers that have to do with significant rise in geopolitical risks and the energy problems and energy imbalances that a lot of the countries are facing today. But in terms of the transition to a new system, I think we are advancing to a different economic system that has to do with a different pattern of trade flows, investment flows, yep. a different geography, if you will. I think we will see a growing role of Asia, first of all, and I think Asia will be probably one of the beneficiaries of the changes that we're likely to see in this economic system. And I think we're more generally, we're likely to see a greater role for the global south, for the developing world, especially if the developing countries undertake measures to open their markets to each other and build platforms of integration, which to a significant degree they're already starting to do. And I think, of course, other aspects of this new world that we're likely to see is alternatives, more alternatives in terms of payment systems, in terms of national currencies yeah. being more intensively used at the expense of the very high degree of dollarization that is still out there, but I think it is set to decline. And we're already seeing these shifts associated with a greater use of national currencies. So all of these trends, I think, will be fundamental, will be long-term, and to a significant degree, they're already starting to be observed.
You know, Andy, the interesting thing, you know, everybody looks at, you know, China as the engine of the global economy as far as manufacturing and exports. But, you know, I mean, it must be very curious from the perspective of Beijing looking at the Europeans essentially isolate themselves from the global economy by cutting off all their trade ties with Russia. I mean, this is self-induced. I mean, you know, there's a lot, you know, coming out of COVID, supply chains, you know, everybody gets that, but we see an economic bloc intentionally limiting its prospects. I mean, it's really quite peculiar. Go ahead, Andy.
Well, let me start with this idea that this economic crisis, whether it's a recession, a depression, or something else entirely, like success has many fathers, as we've heard from the two previous speakers. One thing I do want to elaborate on a bit with this first, Peter, is that the structural changes that are underway are largely driven as we're moving from a unipolar world mm-hmm. to at least a bipolar, if not a multipolar one. And a lot of the roots of what we're seeing now, I think, can be attributed to this. If we look at fragmentation, I'm a little bit less sure this is happening. Professor Lissa Bolick's point that we're witnessing the rise of the global south, look at the regional comprehensive economic partnership that includes the countries of ASEAN, China, Japan, and North Korea that covers a third of the global population, currently a third of global GDP, which is expected to rise to 50% of global GDP by 2050. We're seeing regional blocks. I believe the term that I've heard Professor Lissa Bolick use is platforms. And Europe, I think, is undergoing this attempted separation, decoupling from Russia, but I think the practical realities of it, it's going to be very, very difficult. And frankly, the Europeans have a much greater affinity for Russia than they do the United States. And I think this Faustian bargain, if we will, of the post-World War II order of keeping the U.S. in, Russia, keeping the U.S. in, Germany down, and Russia out, really is crumbling, and we may be at the beginning of a new reordering, you know, whether that's a new security architecture in Europe to a reconfiguration of the entire global system. There's a lot to be pessimistic about, but I think also there are major changes underway that may bring
talking about major changes here. Mitch, let me go back to you here. I mean, the thing that I look at, I agree with everything we've heard here, but the West seems to think it's still in the driver's seat, and I think that that something that that's not particularly relevant anymore? I mean, cutting off trade ties or reordering energy ties and things like that, it's not very easy to do, and particularly if you do it in a way that it impacts you negatively, where, you know, this is, you know, to answer Andy's issue here, this is ideologically driven. This is not common sense driven. Mitch, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, this is it's authoritarian creep is what it is. And, you know, we have to once again, it comes back to what is the truth? I mean, look at what happened in Afghanistan. That was a train wreck. Was anybody held accountable? No, no one was held accountable. You know, look, there's 20% inflation out there now, or it's even higher than that. And they're using the basis for calculation. You know, they're saying the worst in 40 years. If you use the actual basis, the methodology behind the calculations that they changed, you know, you're up around 20% right now. So that's significant. That kills and stifles the consumer in the West. Oil prices are significantly higher. And this is part of a stealth Green New Deal in America that couldn't be passed by legislating it. Yep. So they're doing it behind people's backs by fiat with executive orders. And the same thing is happening in the UK with net zero. So what they're doing is shooting themselves in the foot. And they're making out, you know, Russia to be the boogeyman and saying it's Putin's price hike. But if you look at an oil chart, a crude oil chart, which is, you know, and if you look at a crude oil chart going back to when Biden declared war after his election on fossil fuels, you'll see that before the Ukraine war, crude oil prices were up 200%. So this precipitous rise in crude oil prices has impacted the markets and impacted costs of everything, because diesel fuel is at all-time highs. There's a shortage of jet fuel, and that's why 7,000 flights over the last holiday weekend were canceled. But nobody wants to talk about that.
Nobody wants to talk about it. Yeah, it's really amazing. Because, I mean, the structural problems within the Western economies, they don't want to address it. They want to blame Russia, blame China, blame the Saudis, blame OPEC. That's what we always get here. That's why we're doing this program. Gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We have to go to a hard break. And after that hard break, we'll continue our discussion on the global economy. Stay with RT.
Counter the Russian state control narrative.
Als Teil der Sanktionen gegen Russland gehen die westlichen Länder gegen russische Auslandssender vor.
Mais écoutez, monsieur, c'est pas à vous de décider de qui est journaliste ou pas dans ce pays. On est en France, quoi, c'est pas possible.
We will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine. The state-owned Russia Today and Sputnik.
RT, Sputnik, even our video agency, roughly, all banned on YouTube.
Et merci à vous tous pour votre fidélité et votre soutien.
Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing the global economy. Okay, let's go back to Yaroslav. You're a Russian. You're an economist. You live in Moscow. I keep hearing about the state of the Russian economy from Western media. I would like, you know, succinctly, what is the state of the Russian economy and what are its prospects? When I'm talking about risks and projections of growth. Go ahead.
Well, basically, I think the dire forecasts of a major plunge in the ruble, major spike in inflation, and precipitous decline in GDP, they're not coming to pass. And I think if you look at the past weeks and months, these forecasts have become far less dire. So if you look at the ruble is significantly stronger than where it was before this geopolitical shock. And it's relatively stable at those levels. If you look at inflation, obviously there was an initial shock, an initial increase, but then we're seeing a significant deceleration. And basically in recent weeks, we're seeing inflation that is close to zero. There was even a brief period of deflation. And then if you look at other key indicators such as trade surplus, budget surplus, basically Russia is running twin surpluses. Obviously, high oil prices provide substantial support. But overall, the macroeconomic policy framework is such that the economy was rendered far more immune than was previously thought with regard to these significant restrictions and shocks. So overall, I think that the expectations are improving also with regard to Russia's GDP trajectory. And I think going forward, we're likely to see that the Russian economy will adapt. The decline this year in terms of GDP will be there. It may be on the order of 5 to 6%, but it could be even less in case the external conditions improve and in case further we see continued emphasis on macroeconomic stability.
Andy, what are the lessons China is drawing from all of this? Because, again, you know, Europe is making political, ideological decisions about its future, I think quite foolishly, to be honest with you. But, I mean, you know, China has to see what's going on in the world. And we've all discussed how trading relations are changing. And, you know, what are the main lessons, do you think, that the Beijing leadership is taking from Europe's, I would say, very callous decision making? Go ahead.
Well, I think China is drawing two sets of lessons from this. I think the immediate one is that its position regarding the Ukrainian conflict was correct, which is that all sides should resolve to settle their differences peacefully. The U.S., in looking to cajole, strong-arm China and other countries into condemning Russia, really looks like this is backfiring on the United States. I've written that the U.S. is engaging in three wars against Russia, the proxy shadow military war in the Ukraine, an economic war, and a propaganda war. And one lesson, then, I think, is China's decision to encourage peaceful settlement of this is correct. The larger geopolitical lesson, I think, is this. Again, looking for conflict really is destructive and self-destructive. And the Biden administration's framing of its geopolitical objectives as a fight of democracies against autocracies, I think is really, again, backfiring, because the lesson here that the Biden administration was looking to administer is that this is what happens when you engage in behavior that the world of democracies does not like, and therefore other countries that fall into this camp, China, other countries around the world, should take heed. And I think, in fact, the opposite conclusions are being drawn now. And I think this is very ironic that these are the lessons that I think can be drawn from what's going on in Ukraine.
You know, Mitch, one of the common denominator here, it's all about energy, really. Now, you've already discussed how this is a backdoor to the Green New Deal. I agree with you here, because, you know, if you put it to the voters, they won't vote for it. OK, so this is a backdoor here. But I mean, it's a lose-lose proposition, because it isn't going to work and then you're not going to have energy. I mean, you lose on both sides, Mitch.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of issues here. I mean, I agree with one of the other people on the call here that, look, you've got an autocracy in America. You don't know who's really pulling the strings. You've got a demented president, and nobody wants to talk about that because you're not allowed to say that. You've got authoritarian creep. You've got lack of due process and enforcement of the rule of law, which is a big problem in America. And, it's just winding people up to create division and tribalism. But, as you're saying with the Green New Deal, what's happening is the Federal Reserve is still, and nobody wants to talk about this either. They're doing quantitative easing. They're buying $120 billion worth of bonds per month. And that's supposed to stop this month. But as I famously said, you can never taper a Ponzi scheme. So the NASDAQ, as a result, has dropped 35% from its peak. So, and that's without them dropping the bond buys. So you've got a lot of debt out there on the market that needs to be refinanced. And you've got the most incompetent person on the planet in the form of Janet Yellen, who created this mess when she was at the Federal Reserve for nearly two decades, yep, has been moved over to run the Treasury. She has no clue at what she's doing. Remember, she's told us for years that inflation is transitory. And I've been warning for years that if you keep printing money, eventually what you're going to do is create inflation, hyperinflation, and a economic tsunami, which is what you saw in Japan. That's now, Japan has been doing it for 30 years, and Japan's the first tip of the iceberg to get hit, but it's happening in the West, and it's going to get a lot worse. And people need to realize you could see $250 to $300 oil or even higher, and that will kill the Western economies. It will kill the global economy as well. And I don't think that's out of the question. I don't think people are preparing for it. However, look, this is not all doom and gloom. I think that there's going to be massive amounts of opportunity when you get valuations coming back to normality, because the valuations of some of these NASDAQ zombie companies that the QE has enabled by the reckless policies of the profligate government and the central banks, when these get washed out, you're going to see a massive amount of defaults, and there's going to be opportunities to buy prime assets at highly discounted prices for those who aren't highly geared. And I think that that's the problem. They've allowed too much debt, credit, and leverage. Right. I talk about it in my book, to get out of hand. And it's got to come back to every market when it gets out of hand. And I've seen this happen many times. And this is just a replay, yeah, of what we've seen many times before. But you need people that understand how to take advantage of these markets. And that's what I do for a living. So, I've seen it happen before. And this is an old playbook. And you've got to have truth resurrected as well. You can't have the Ministry of Truth that Biden still has running, even though that crazy woman, yeah, Nina Jankowicz or whatever her name is, they said, well, she's been sidelined. But that program is still going. It's alive and well. And that's a danger. That's the danger to democracy.
Well, I know what it means to when they attack what they call disinformation. Okay, 17 years of hard work disappeared for me. Okay, they're trying, but they're not going to succeed. Yaroslav, let me go back to you. I see a silver lining in a lot of this here. Ever since 2014, Russia has been dealing with sanctions, and I think reorienting itself away from the West is the thing to do. We see so many, because they let everything become political, and I think that, import substitution, all these other things are a good thing, and it will drive productivity. Your thoughts, go ahead.
Yes, my sense is that, there are a lot of things that are overdue that are likely to be now expedited due to the events that we're seeing. Import substitution is one, and certainly there has been some success in some key areas like agriculture where import substitution has worked. There are clearly the key challenge that I see now is in the industrial sector, where I think a greater emphasis will be needed with respect to building value-added chains with partners from the Eurasian Union, with China, with other countries from the Global South. And generally, I think we're already seeing trends of greater diversification, yep, of Russia's economy, Russia's trade being directed more towards Asia, towards the faster growing economies. And clearly there are significant opportunities there because these are the economies that are growing faster. And these are the economies that have the scope to reduce import barriers significantly. That provides in turn a significant margin for Russian producers, for Russian exporters. And of course, there is a greater need for Russia to diversify into Asia and to explore markets there, as there are these restrictions coming from the West that that make it all the more important for Russia to finally, have its exports directed towards the
Anderson, let me jump in here and give Andy the last word here. We have 45 seconds here. When will the Global South have its own SWIFT system? Because the West has abused the SWIFT system. Go ahead.
Well, I'd say keep an eye on what's happening with China's digital currency, its central bank digital currency, what it calls the digital currency electronic payment. This is not only a new currency, it's actually a new system of payment that is a token into an entirely new world of relating with money, whether you're a individual, a company, or a government. And I think that we will be seeing this unfolding before our very eyes in the next several years.
Well, it can't happen fast enough, I'm afraid. All right, gentlemen, that's all the time we have. Fascinating discussion. I want to thank my guests in New York, Beijing, and here in Moscow. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, crosstalk rules.